From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Sneaker culture is a huge business, but it's also a celebration of design innovation.
It was about not just cushioning your feet, but it became technology with the bubble. And then it became status, you know, like, hey, these are limited edition. You're a big deal if you can get one of these.
Sneakerhead and KCRW DJ Anthony Valadez joins us for a tour of Sneakertopia later in the show. And we're going to check out an exhibition of classic movie monsters that draw inspiration from natural history. First, though, fire season is engulfing northern and southern California. This week, it's been the turn of the West Side. The Getty Fire has caused thousands to be evacuated. Some homes have been lost, and there have been concerns about the Getty Center and its contents. The Getty Trust's VP of Communications, Lisa Lapin, talked to us by phone Monday and told us that the Hilltop Institution, designed by the architect Richard Meyer, is a very, very safe place for art.
We take tremendous precautions related to fire prevention here because we were up on the top of a hill and surrounded by wildland. So our buildings are made of stone and metal, and we have stone roofs, and we do aggressive brush clearance, and we store water on site so that we can prevent fires ourselves if we see something. And the firefighters have been aggressive with the air tankers, air helicopters, and tanker planes. Those planes have really done amazing work in putting this fire down. And inside, everything is very tightly sealed. So while it's extremely smoky outside, inside the art is fine, and our air systems have been shut off so that no smoke can get into the art areas or into the area where we store our vast art library and archives.
Now, one of the artworks at the Getty is its garden, which was designed by the artist Robert Irwin. We asked Lisa about that.
The garden is fine. The garden is on the south side of our campus, and the fire has been north and west. A lot of vegetation is going to be gone. The vistas are going to be different, you know, to the north and to the west.
That's Lisa Lapin at the Getty Trust. Now, her last point about the vegetation got us wondering about those air tankers she mentioned and that hot pink fire retardant that is used by firefighters to slow the spread of fires. Is it safe for California's people, animals, and its native and non-native plants? We asked landscape designer Wade Graham. He told us that the product, named Foscheck, was originally owned by Monsanto. It's a combination of mostly water, also fertilizer and other additives, colouring and chemicals.
The use has really ballooned over the last few years. In essence, it's just fertilizer with some chemicals in it, and we do know that in concentrated doses it kills fish in streams, it kills wildlife if with a direct hit. We do also know that you're introducing huge nutrient loads into landscapes that probably don't want those. They're minerally poor soils. It's going to encourage weed growth. It's going to encourage grasses that burn more frequently. So there's certainly an environmental effect to heavy use of this stuff, you know, and in another sense, what you're doing is maybe it's just a show of force. Maybe this is a psychological warfare to show people that we're doing something. We like to see planes bombing from the air, defeating the enemy. But really, these landscapes are burning in part because we've excluded fire, because we have a policy of total fire suppression. These are fire landscapes. Some amount of fire needs to be permitted in these landscapes. Otherwise, you just have a war, an endless kind of a war.
I had read that native plantings might be negatively impacted by this fire retardant more than non-native plantings. Some of those native plantings are in those vistas that you get when you are up at the top of the Getty. So when Lisa Lapin tells us that the vista is going to be impacted by the fires, is that partly what she might be referring to?
Well, there's a vicious cycle going on in the Southern California landscape, which is that we have excluded fire from these areas where we built homes up into the wild landscapes in order to save those homes. But what you get is really big fires and much more frequent, so that the chaparral, the native vegetation, is in many cases unable to reproduce because they're burning too hot and too frequently. And what we're seeing is non-native plants like grasses, African fountain grass, things like that, annuals sort of replacing them. And those things can burn every year and still come back. So many hillsides in the Santa Monica Mountains are already no longer native. They're being replaced by this sort of fire-loving grass ecology. And that is a bit of a tragedy. And that may be the vista that we see changing, particularly in the Sepulveda Pass area around the Getty, where the fire has been so frequent recently. We're not going to see native vegetation in there anymore.
That was landscape designer and writer Wade Graham. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Yes, Halloween is upon us. And if you're planning to dress up, you may be thinking of those old spooky favourites. A mummy, a vampire, Frankenstein's monster. But have you ever wondered about the origin stories of those scary creatures? Well, you can find out at the Natural History Museum of LA County in an exhibit called Natural History of Horror. It takes up only one small room, but it attracted a big crowd at a preview that I went to. And while there, I spoke to the curator and designer of the show, Sarah Crawford.
I'm not from Los Angeles, but I realized living here for the last couple of years that this is such a big topic. It's so popular. So it seems like the right place to be doing it.
Can you account for this? Does it have anything to do with the presence of Hollywood, or is it too much sun, or what is it?
That's a good question. I mean, yeah, maybe it's in reaction. We have such, you know, sunny, non-horror movie weather here. Maybe we're all looking for a little bit of escape.
So you walk in and the first exhibit is The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
It is. And, you know, the backbone of this exhibition is about the scientific discoveries and inspirations that inspired these famous movie monsters. And The Creature from the Black Lagoon is the perfect story to talk about that with. There was a rediscovery of this ancient fish called the coelacanth in the 1930s. And basically it was thought to be extinct for millions of years. And then scientists pulled one live out of the ocean. And so that later became the inspiration from The Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is supposed to be this long extinct creature that gets rediscovered by scientists. So it's a very similar story.
Science couldn't explain it, but there it was, alive in the deep, deep waters of the Amazon. A throwback to a creature that had existed 100 million years ago, immensely strong and destructive.
And so it's fun to have these two models. We have a model of the coelacanth that was built in the Natural History Museum for visitors to show the anatomy of this fish. And then we have a model of the creature from the Black Lagoon. So it's kind of fun to see similarities and differences between the two.
And then your other famed horror figures are Frankenstein and Dracula. And again, what you're doing with this show is illustrating the science behind these imaginaries.
It's true. And then we also have The Mummy, which is actually one of my favorite ones, because that was directly inspired by the opening of King Tut's tomb in 1922. And then a decade later, you get the movie The Mummy.
The Mummy. Is it dead or alive? Human or inhuman? You'll know. You'll see. You'll feel the awful, creeping, crawling terror that stands your hair on end and brings a scream to your lips.
And this idea of the curse that came out after King Tut's tomb was open, you know, there were some deaths associated with the opening of the tomb, and then this became sensationalized, and then later you have a film, The Mummy, that takes advantage of, you know, that kind of media frenzy around the opening of the tomb.
Dracula, it seems, drew its inspiration actually from people's actual fear of rabies that came from bats. Is that right?
So the vampire myth has a ton of different origins. And one of the ones that we thought tied really well into this exhibition is the fear of contagion. There's some recent research that has shown that it's possible that rabies was an origin for the vampire legend. There's some similarities there. You get foaming at the mouth, you get aversion to water and other strong smells like garlic. And then you also kind of get people tend to be a little more sexual when they're infected with rabies. And so there's some theories that may have inspired the vampire legend. So we pull out a vampire bat from our collection and then also a wolf skull, both which are carriers of rabies occasionally. And then also Dracula can morph into those two creatures. So another interesting tie.
This is Dracula, the original terrifying story of a maniac and a man who lived after death. Lived on human blood, took the form of a vampire bat, and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Dracula!
And then finally, Frankenstein. It takes its inspiration from actual experiments being done in electrification of animals. Is that right?
Yeah, and that was the one that was a huge surprise to me. So there was a gentleman in the late 1700s named Luigi Galvani who was doing experiments in animal electricity, and he actually took a frog's leg and attached it to like a lightning rod, essentially, and then waited till a storm and then saw that the lightning caused the leg to twitch. And his nephew actually took his research even further and ended up touring Europe with shocking dead animals in front of audiences. And then, you know, there's a report that he did this also with a corpse. And Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, mentions galvanism and these theories of this scientist in the opening for Frankenstein. So she was clearly inspired by, you know, a lot of the scientific work that was happening at the time. And it sounds like she was inspired by Galvani as well.
When this dead hand moves, the monster created by a man they called Mad is turned loose to strike terror into the hearts of men.
So fascinating. So for you as curator and designer of this exhibition, you spent time in the archives of the Natural History Museum, but did you also spend time in Hollywood's archives, as in the warehouses containing the models of the old monsters?
Well, I didn't spend time in those warehouses, but I did spend time talking to their archivist. You know, they have a lot of material to go through, and so they kind of guided me and pushed me in the right direction. So we were able to get film clips from Universal Studios and then also film stills. So they really helped us work on this exhibition. And it's really striking to me just how beautiful these movies are. I mean, just the shadow, the play between shadow and light, and just, you know, the way the sets were constructed. I mean, they're just stunning pieces. They're artworks, you know, and so we have them as the backdrop when you're experiencing this exhibition. We wanted people to not just follow the plot, but to just appreciate the artistry. And we still have, you know, designers, monster designers that come to the museum. You know, we have millions and millions of specimens that are wonderful inspiration. We actually had a team come in recently to look at some of our herpetology collection as inspiration for, you know, the new Godzilla movie. So this happens all the time. You know, we want artists to come here. We want designers to come here and use our specimens to, you know, as inspiration in the work that they do.
Just remind us, what is herpetology?
Well, that's mostly lizards and frogs and snakes, things of that nature.
That's Sarah Crawford. She runs exhibition design at the Natural History Museum. Now, at a preview of the show, Natural History of Horror, we ran into Kamara Chamberlain. She writes a horror blog and she was wearing a Blackula t-shirt. I asked her for her reaction to the exhibit.
This exhibit really takes you into the heart of all of the history of horror, from the creature of the Black Lagoon to Dracula and Frankenstein, which are all of these horror staples in a lot of people's lives. And in a time where we feel like we're not connected to the person next to us, or we don't have anything in common, monsters and the horror genre remind us that we all love these creatures and we're much more connected than we originally thought that we were.
Why do you think we are so preoccupied with Frankenstein, which is really pretty terrifying, the idea of intervening with the creation of human beings?
You know, I think Frankenstein's always had a couple different feelings about him. There are the folks who are very afraid of him, that unknown kind of bumbling monster just with one thing on his mind. But also, what a terrifying and very sad way to be as well, to kind of be thrown into an existence that you don't really know anything about. You don't know how you came to be. And I mean, how many of us have been thrown into situations that we're uncomfortable with and we've had to do the exact same thing? We've just had to exist and survive and fight our way through. And I think Frankenstein is more human and more of a part of us than we think he is.
That's Kamara Chamberlain. She's a horror film fanatic, and we met her at the Natural History of Horror. The show is up at the Natural History Museum of LA County in Expo Park through April of next year. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now, do you consider sneakers art? If so, you're going to want to visit Sneakertopia, coming up after this break. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Sneakers are very, very big business, a nearly $20 billion industry in the US alone. Limited edition kicks are released weekly, with collectors lining up overnight to get their hands on a rare pair to then resell online at significant markups. If you are in sneaker culture, you are a sneakerhead. And now you can celebrate the sneaker life in all its glory at a new pop-up themed experience called Sneakertopia. It's in an empty retail space at HHLA. That's the rebrand of what was known as the Promenade at Howard Hughes Center off of the 405. Justin Fredericks curated Sneakertopia.
So Sneakertopia is a celebration of sneaker culture, and we celebrate it by bringing guests along the journey of it through all the fields that it has influenced and been influenced by, from sports, music, film, fashion, art, design, and so forth.
So what will you find at this exhibition?
Right, so we do that through massive, large-scale installations, so larger-than-life murals, sculptures, and alongside these immersive installations that people can literally step into and put their own kind of footprint on each scene, we have some of the rarest sneakers in the world on display and actually for sale through a really big sneaker collector. So we kind of merge the kind of contemporary immersiveness with the historical context and culture.
So, Sneakertopia is part museum, part store. It also has a made-up brand called Frugal, a kind of parody of Supreme, the skateboarding and streetwear brand. But the show is not about commerce, says Justin.
Honestly, the merchandising of the exhibit from the store and from even the selling of sneakers was an add-on. Really, the primary core experience is about celebrating this culture that spans across many decades and is cross-generational and is aspirational and inspirational. The thing that I love about it is it's very forward-looking. You see a lot of installations that are kind of projecting what the future of sneaker culture will look like, but then it's also super nostalgic, where you know you get brought back to that time where you wore your first, you know, Jordans or the first Reebok pumps. And then it's cross-generational because, you know, kids who grew up in the 80s are now adults with kids of their own. And, you know, some of those kids might be loving Under Armours because of Steph Curry, but their parents love, you know, still the Jordans. So there's that cross-generational bond as well. So I was 5 years old when the first Jordans came out, but my real deep memory of my first experience with sneakers, because I love the intersection of sneakers, art, and technology, were the Reebok pumps. And I remember being obsessed with this shoe that I could actually inflate on around my foot, to the point where I wore my first Reebok pumps down till like I couldn't wear them again, and I wanted to preserve the technology. So I cut the tongue and the pump out of that sneaker and tried to slip it into every other sneaker I owned. I mean, I failed as an inventor and in trying to apply it to other sneakers, but I remembered, wow, like, this is crazy that this like pump technology and when there wasn't a new pump yet, I really wanted to use it in every other sneaker that I had. So that was my real first memory of attaching myself to the sneaker culture world.
That's the curator of Sneakertopia, Justin Fredericks. We visited Sneakertopia with our colleague, KCRW DJ Anthony Valadez, and that's because he knows sneakers. He toured the show, he talked to artists, went to the opening party, and delivered this reaction.
Wow, there's a lot to take in visually upon first stepping in. It's really cool in a sense that there's a wall with all these incredible figures that are devoted to sneaker culture, legendary DJs, athletes, shoe designers. And my first takeaway from stepping in is the span of time from nostalgia to the future. It's then and now and tomorrow in many ways.
Single out a couple of the installations that are really telling this story.
I think just the playoff nostalgia, and each one of these pieces has a piece of that, from Man One's murals of various rappers and singers. I love the fact that the sneaker is the essential component in terms of size. The sneakers are exaggerative. They're big. And if you see what's happening today in sneaker culture, that's still being utilized. Virgil Abloh, who designs for Nike, does that with the excessive bold Nike air quotations, and I think there's a big playoff exaggerative, and that's what I'm seeing a lot of here.
Is it remarkable to you, though, given what you've just said, to turn sneakers, really essentially create a museum to sneakers? Why is it that they mean so much?
It's a great question. Like, when I grew up, we were poor. Like, there were the Jordans that we couldn't afford, and there were, like, the $40 sneakers. So to get a fresh pair of Jordans when you got your first job meant a big deal. There was status, right? And you're wearing these sneakers, and you're basically the king of your block, and you couldn't wait to go to the club and breakdance in them. And this was like, I exist, I'm here. And to now see this play, and even corporations realizing the value of what we did when we were broke, is interesting. It's been an interesting journey, and now it's, you know, it's commercialized beyond, I mean, value. It's amazing, the resell community of buying a $100 pair of shoes and then selling them online for a couple thousand. It's mind-blowing. So for me, it's something I wrestle with. You know, this was something that was sacred and I was passionate about.
But still, you know, one of the things that you're hearing from the PR company that's promoting this exhibit is that what you find here is millions of dollars worth of sneakers. Did you see the millions of dollars worth? Describe it.
I did. These were called the one-in-ones, in which only one of those sneakers were created as samples. So, like, I saw a pair of the Kobes, which just one was made for him to approve. And then if it made it along the line, cool. If it didn't, there's still that one that exists. And I saw about 12 of them. And those are amazing to think that only one pair of those shoes exists. Can you imagine if you had that pair of shoe? Like, you could probably put your kids, grandkids through college off that one sneaker that was a sample. You know, and another component to think about is the amount of creativity that goes into these sneakers. You know, when they were initially created, it was for basketball, sports, playing. And then somehow it went beyond that. It was about not just cushioning your feet, but it became technology with the bubble. And then it became status, you know, like, hey, these are limited edition. You're a big deal if you can get one of these. And then, but that requires you waiting in line. So you have to go to these sneaker shops before doors are open, sometimes the night before, and camp out just to get this one pair of sneaker, you know?
Did you camp outside Undefeated anytime?
I did, and I loved it because you're amongst your tribe of fellow sneaker collectors, and you tell stories about what you did to get this sneaker, and just, you know, you're with your tribe.
Are you still a big sneaker collector?
Well, I've changed my motto in that. Rather than collecting sneakers, I'd rather collect memories. And so I'd rather travel. But don't get me wrong, I'll go to Japan and I'll see a pair of sneakers and I'll grab them.
When you travel, what sneakers are you wearing?
Oh, easy. I'm a big fan of moccasins. So Nike and Adidas actually have invested into moccasin-like sneakers. There's a timelessness. It is yesterday and tomorrow. And I love that.
You heard Anthony mention the veteran street artist Man One. He contributed an entire room to Sneakertopia, styled to look like a music festival. There's a stage made to look like a blue Adidas shoebox and a big mural with colourful drawings of hip-hop stars like Kendrick Lamar, Missy Elliott, Travis Scott and the late Nipsey Hussle, all wearing oversized sneakers. Anthony asked Man One about how he paired the stars with the shoes.
Well, some of them had specific sneakers, you know, that were put out by the brands, and some of them, they just like to rock them, you know. So some were very specific because of their connection, you know, like Rihanna and Puma and obviously like Kanye and the Nike and the Adidas. Well, the Kendrick Lamar, Cortez, you know. So they all were actual sneakers that they put out or dropped or that they just rock, you know.
Sneakers, let's bring it back to that. What is your relationship to sneakers?
My relationship to sneakers, I'm not a collector of sneakers necessarily, but I have a lot of different sneakers that I wear for different reasons. But going back, I think my first memory of a sneaker was when I got Vans black and white checkered high tops. Because I was a B-boy, and you know, you saw it in the videos when people are moonwalking with the sneaker, and to me that was like the dopest thing, you know. So that was like my first sneaker that I ever like actually went out and bought. Like, but you know, for me, sneakers nowadays, I love to customize them, you know. So I bought a pair of Superstars with the fat shoelaces, and I'd customize them. I love that.
Real quick, for our listeners listening, you mentioned fat laces.
Yeah.
You and I know what that embodies and the power behind that. For somebody who doesn't know about fat laces, how would you explain that to them?
Oh, man. How would I explain that? They're fat. They're fat laces. And the other thing about the shoelaces, you know, when you're a B-boy, when you're a breakdancer and you're in hip-hop, especially back in the day, the Shaltos with fat laces, the Pumas, you know, with fat laces. And they also come in different colors, right? But the thing about it is you got to know how to fold it and how to make it cross over. So it's got to have a look. It's very unique. It's hard to explain, but you know, it's definitely a B-boy style. History's been
Now back to the basics. Back to Adidas with the fat lace. Back
to the aqua. That's Man One, speaking to KCRW's Anthony Valadez. Anthony also got to talk to another artist at Sneakertopia. She's called Sophie Mazzaro, and she has a display of sneakers on which she has painted designs.
I was always a sneakerhead and always a tomboy growing up in Berlin, and I kind of did graffiti and all that stuff, so you always needed to have shoes that you can run away in, and I always wore flats, and then the U.S. had the sneaker culture, so I had to order everything from the U.S., and it was hard to get my hands on some of the shoes, so I customized my own.
Okay, there's so much I want to talk to you about what you just said. Let's rewind a little bit. You brought up a great point, being a graffiti writer, tagging. You had to have a good pair of shoes to not just only have good footing for painting, but for running from cops. Did you ever have those experiences? And what were your favorite pair of shoes to wear?
I've never been caught. I've definitely had the experience of running, and we all did because we just did stupid stuff and, you know, tagged bus stations and trains and whatnot. And it changed a lot there. But my favorite pair of shoes, and I still have it, it's a Nike Blazer pair. It's just fabric, but they're so easy to wear. They have a lot of support and they last forever.
Outside of graffiti, what was your first collision of the two worlds coming together, that being art and sneakers? Were you always designing or coloring on sneakers?
So I've been painting and decorating and designing since I was 6 years old, and everything is a canvas to me. I mean, I paint on my jackets, on hoodies, on backpacks. Someone asked me to paint on their car. There's just nothing that's off limits to me. I've painted an entire mansion, including the roof, with like a 60-foot boom, and there's no limit.
A mansion versus a sneaker. A mansion sounds like a lot, but there's a lot of detail. I'm looking at your amazing artwork right in front of me. For folks who don't know, what are we looking at, and how much detail does that involve when it comes to painting?
So some of my favorite shoes to paint on are the Jordans and also Vans, because they just give you most canvas to paint on. Vans are more of a canvas area. It's different paints, also a different process. Like Nikes and those leather shoes are way more difficult because you have to strip them off the layer. It comes factory sealed, and you have to take that layer off so you can paint on it and reseal it at the end. And there's just so much that goes into it, and each pair is like 18 to 20 hours on average. And people underestimate how long it really takes.
Do you design these sneakers on commission?
I do both. I do commissions for people, and I do get some celebrities. Like, I've worked with Steve Aoki, Justin Bieber, Diplo, Halle Berry. But I also sometimes have my own ideas for designs and then just do those.
That's Sophie Mazzaro, visual artist and sneaker customizer, talking to KCRW's DJ Anthony Valadez. Catch Anthony weekend afternoons on KCRW. Sneakertopia is on view at HHLA through January. See images of the show at kcrw.com/DNA. Thank you for listening to today's DNA. Avishai Artsy produced and edited the show with a final mix by Ray Guana. We'll be back next week. Please, Lex, use an entertainer. Forget air, cross trainer, free container. Polos, Mark 5s, and Elises, the fly pieces. This should be on the back, man. Features, Hoyas, Cortez's, any tonics, feeling bionic.